The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. You're very welcome along to the programme for this Friday, the 10th of July 2026. It's 4 minutes past nine and we've got a packed show lined up for you over the course of the next 2 hours. Seamus Gunn's going to be joining us after 10 o'clock where we will have a chat and of course get the questions that you've been submitting to us answered. If you've got a question for Seamus, 086 60 25 000, that's the WhatsApp and text number, 086 60 25 000. We're also going to be previewing the Greg Hughes podcast release today. We've got two very special guests, Ethna and Colin Bell, who will be joining us this week. That podcast released at 11 a.m, but we'll have a wee preview for you just after 10. And we'll look forward to the weekend's GE action, of course, two huge games, All-Ireland semi-finals. We'll see what Brendan Devaney thinks of those two games, who he backs to come out on top. That and so much more besides. I'll remind you of the telephone number and the WhatsApp and text number one more time, 086 60 25 000. WhatsApps and texts, of course, 07491 25 000, or email comments@highlandradio.com. Right, let's say good morning to our panel. I'll say good morning first to Katie Tyrrell McCafferty, community campaigner. Good morning, Katie. How are you?
Good morning, Greg. Fine, thank you.
Good to have you on the programme. Senator Niall Blaney of Fianna Fáil is with us as well. Good morning to you, Niall.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Not too bad at all. A quick word before we await our third guest. In relation to the news there, we're hearing about this effigy on top of a bonfire in Northern Ireland. I know you take, like many of us, Niall, a strong interest in matters in Northern Ireland. Are we moving further away, are we, to sort of more tolerance to, you know, different people of different colour, different religions?
I think it's a picture of where we are at in the world, Greg, as an angry society. And I suppose the hot topic of immigration and our tolerances for others. It's just a difficult time in the world. It really is a pity that these things happen. It's a little bit sad, but it is what it is.
And I'm not in any way trying to trivialise it, but, you know, sometimes, say if you watch the St. Patrick's Day parade, there'll be a theme or something and people try and make it relevant to whatever for reaction in an extremely offensive way. I wonder, do the people who construct these fires sort of spend, well, what can we put on this that will get the most public reaction, the most controversy? You know what I mean? Is that what the top of these bonfires are being used for now? What can upset the most amount of people?
Yeah, I've no doubt. A lot of it's driven by hate. And nothing was ever achieved in the world through hate. We need to get to the situation where tolerances are much better and widespread in relation to dealing with religion, differences, diversity of all kinds, Greg. We all need to learn to give space for each other to live and have respect for each other.
Katie Tyrrell McCafferty, you look on and see this mosque on the top of this huge, enormous stack of wood. What do you think when you see it?
I'm absolutely disgusted by it, to be honest. But then these are the people that, you know, were celebrating 1 year, if you remember, back, the death of a child from cancer because he was a Celtic fan, you know. I think they're the worst of society, to be honest. You know, this was a child that was of the same, not obviously from a Christian background, let's just say. So any difference to them is not tolerated. You know, I've lived near a mosque. I had no issue with living near a mosque. When I lived in London, one of the biggest mosques, actually. I think there's a lot of misinformation put out about Muslims, and I have many Muslim friends. Like every, as I always say, there's good and bad in all, and you'll get dodgy people from every religion, but most Muslims I know are quite peaceful people and just want to practice their religion in peace.
Deputy Piers Doherty, Sinn Féin's finance spokesperson, is with us as well. We were just having a brief comment there in relation to the news carried at nine there on the programme about police trying to intervene to have this effigy removed from the top of this bonfire. It was set on fire, so any evidence is going to be destroyed. But it's regrettable, to say the very least, Piers, that we still see this type of activity, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely, Greg. The issues here in relation to the 12th and what goes on aren't anything new. This has been going on for now years in relation to, you know, certain parts of loyalism. And I don't want to paint everybody, you know, from a unionist tradition in the same way. I spoke to people who came from the union's tradition this week, who actually attended the United Ireland debate that we had in Leinster House and actually sees their future in a new and shared Ireland. So, I, as I said, I don't want to paint everybody with the same brush, but let's be clear about this here. This, you know, how many times, how many years have we seen the pictures of my colleagues, people who are elected representative representing Sinn Féin, being burnt on the top of these bonfires? In some cases, these bonfires are held in public land and council land, and the council refuses to go in and actually deal with the issue. And that's because, you know, and you can see that the DUP courts the support of hardline loyalism in relation to this. So this isn't surprising to me, you know, that this is where loyalism is at.
But and is it not, how can we have a situation, though, regardless of who's responsible to it, that there is no law of the land or it's not enforced?
There is law.
Yes, but
there is law of the land.
Enforced, I mean. So in terms of, you know, the council knowing what's coming, sort of the police know what's coming, the police try and get on site, it's set on fire. I mean, is there another country in the world, a civilised country in the world, where that would be allowed to happen?
Yeah, like, and you know, it's been normalised, unfortunately, for a lot of times. Like, you know, is it acceptable that posters of either myself or others are burnt on 12th of July? Now, it doesn't really bother me, but, you know, personally, it wouldn't bother me. But what it does is it sends a signal that this type of hate, this type of intolerance is acceptable. And there's a wider issue here, because, look, the people who build these bonfires and the people who end up putting these effigies up on these on the bonfires, I didn't see this one, but it's been described to me. But like, I've seen ones in the past where there's been people, you know, in nooses hanging from a bonfire. Like, that isn't just, you know, a bit of crack or whatever somebody thinks. That is serious. Like, and, you know, we've had death threats against our members. I'm sure other political parties have as well. It's, you know, and it just takes somebody who thinks that this is okay or that this is acceptable to actually to carry out some type of activity in relation to this here. The wider thing, Greg, is this, is that whatever about the people who actually do this, you know, the small number of individuals who put these on the top of the bonfires or put the posters or the effigies, there's a whole community then that gathers and somehow accepts that it is okay. And that's where there really needs to be a wider community response in relation to in terms of the education. I understand, you know, to a certain degree, I don't understand and don't tolerate and don't condone at all anything that's happened in terms of the hate crimes we see around the 12th of July. But I do understand that there is a community that feels that they are kind of left behind under siege. Like, everybody, I know we may talk about United Ireland later on, like, people know that the direction of travel in terms of where things are going here. The problem is that political unionism won't face up to that and have real conversations with their community. And as a result of that, there we have a community that feels actually under threat. These are discussions I've had with loyalist communities going back 15 years ago. So what we do need is a bit of leadership. And I think what you're seeing a lot in terms of these type of displays is actually to do with a community that knows the direction of travel, is being told by their leaders, don't worry about anything, but sees all the signs there. And that's why you see some stuff, like, you go through some communities in the north and you see, like, Israeli flags flying now, you know, like, it just doesn't make sense. Like, there is no connection between loyalism and Israeli flags.
You see Palestinian flags flying as well.
But there's a natural connection there, Greg, between Palestinian the Palestinian people and nationalism. The same way that, you know, when South Africa and Nelson Mandela came here, he made it very clear that his staunchest supporters, his greatest friends, were those within the Republican movement. movement in the Republican circles. It is why Jerry Adams was the pallbearer at Mandela's funeral. There is connections of people who are, you know, communities that have been colonized and those that are in struggle. So the point is that those ties have been there for not, you know, the last number of years, but tens of years. What I'm saying in terms of loyalism and Israel, those ties don't exist. It is a reaction to something else. It is a reaction to a direction of travel. And that is a serious issue. But I think there's a wider conversation that needs to happen. And look, you know, we would have seen some of it where you've seen senior ministers standing, you know, recently at protests where, you know, people were, you know, were hooded. And, you know, thinking that that is all acceptable and that is all normal. And I think there's a real big conversation that needs to happen within unionism and loyalism. And if it doesn't happen, I think you're going to continue to see a lot of this. But to my...
Okay, I'll come back to you. Niall Blaney, would you agree that there needs to be quite a bit of inward looking within the loyalist unionist community?
Yeah, well, first of all, I strongly agree with Piers that anybody's pictures or any... outline of an individual on top of a bonfire and a noose is completely wrong and needs to be called out. The analogy of Pierce there in relation to Nelson Mandela and coming here to paint a picture of his association with nationalism is something I must have missed, Greg. You know, and if Sinn Féin feel that strongly about Palestine, why have they facilitated the passing of a planning application which enables the more manufacturing of F-35 bombers in Northern Ireland, which in turn is going to Israel?
Do you not know how it works, Niall? Do you want me to explain that to you? I'll explain. Just give me 2 seconds. First of all, you should know, and I'm sure you do, because I think you're the spokesperson, are you, on the issues in the North, that elected representatives have no power in relation to planning permission in the North. That's the first thing. The second thing is you should also know that the executive, including Michelle O'Neill, are very clear that no funding, no money and no manufacturing of arms should be going anywhere near the North. And the third thing you should have known is if you actually witnessed the funeral of Nelson Mandela, you would have known that his friends and comrades made sure that Jerry Adams was the pallbearer. That's the person, just to explain, who stood beside his coffin along with Richard McCauley. And I think, you know, it doesn't take my words to explain to you the connection between Nelson Mandela and the Republican movement. But I think actually asking Jerry Adams and Richard McCauley to stand there as dignitaries from all across the world come to visit and watch his funeral is probably the best example of Nelson's own view and the South African's view of the connection between our struggle and theirs.
Point made, Niall. Do you want to just finish your point, or?
Yeah, maybe I can finish the next time, Greg. So, can I just take the point in relation to the planning application? Councillors actually vote the planning applications in Northern Ireland, and the Sinn Féin representatives facilitated that planning application going through. And that's the reality of it. What you said the second time in relation to Mandela is much different than what you said the first time, Greg. But moreover, if you look at the areas in Northern Ireland that I suppose where the heat is in areas in Belfast, loyalist areas in Belfast, you have the same in nationalist areas, Greg, where you have regions of up to 30% and 40% unemployment. And you have to ask yourself after the generations that have come through since the peace process, what has been done by political parties and politicians in Northern Ireland to address this, to address even looking after their own. Instead, you have constant blame of the UK government not giving enough funds, but do nothing themselves to raise funds to try and sort out the issues in Northern Ireland. And when we get on to
what do you mean? What mechanisms are there for the political parties in the North to raise funds themselves?
Well, every time it comes around to raising funds like maybe water charges or something to try and help the people in Northern Ireland, it's been refused. If you look at late, there's been 400 jobs cut in Ulster University. The further erosion of that's a decline in lectures, but the decline also in further education, colleges for further education. young people aren't getting a chance to train, to get jobs. And then when it comes to the Irish unity, you know, we can't do all the heavy lifting from
this side. We'll get on to that, and I'm going to bring Katie into this whole conversation, of course, as well. But do you want to respond directly just to that point, Pearce, about, you know, elected representatives in the North doing more to raise funds to improve and address, as Niall, he can't be disputed, you know, high levels of unemployment and great levels of disquiet?
Well, look, listen, I don't really need to, I think, to respond to this here. Like, Niall, look, and this is probably the way that the conversation will go. Niall will just continue to attack Sinn Féin and all this because that's the way Niall is. But anyway, look, we'll see how this goes.
Listen, yeah, but you're not a Fianna Fáil cheerleader either, Pearce.
Let me just answer his question, Greg. Sinn Féin will not be introducing water charges, Niall. You may want us to introduce water charges in the north. You may say that that's a way of raising funds in the north. It's the only suggestion you have, by the way. How much water charges would you like to impose on people to actually fund the needs of the north? Like, are you really serious? And do you not understand that actually that makes life harder for communities, whether they're in the Bogside or whether they're in the Falls or whether they're actually on in loyalist communities either? So we will not be raising water charges. It's something obviously you wanted to see right across the state, but that's your only solution, because the reality is, Greg, and it was a good question, the economic levers don't exist in terms of the north. We can't raise taxation. The only things that you can raise funds on are actually on rates or on water charges, and like, that's just putting more pressure on ordinary families. The real problem here, which actually all of the parties, not just Sinn Féin, every single party, the SDLP, the DUP, the Ulster Unionists, Sinn Féin, the Alliance Party, are all agreed that that the North is underfunded, and that is why our ministers are meeting with the Exchequer and with the probably the incoming Prime Minister in a couple of weeks, and that's one of the key issues that will be raised in relation to that there, because we do need support for communities in the North. And it's like, you know, so the executive is like Donegal County Council to a certain degree. They do not have the ability to raise money beyond increasing rates or local property tax, and the executive's the same. So we are dependent because of partition.
Well, they can raise money through match borrowing and using the local property tax.
Not the executive. The executive doesn't have the power to do that. They have limited power in terms of borrowing, so they can't go to the markets, they can't do that. And the same with the council as well. The council has a limit in relation to what it can borrow, and it has to get approval by the department.
We'll Any back. Chance of a voice of an ordinary person getting in here?
Well,
maybe you might learn something.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, please. We're all ordinary, though. You know.
Well, I'm not an elected representative. I'm actually a carer. So, you know. But let's. In relation to the north, I want to say something actually about the funding at the University of Ulster. Many, 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 many people from the Republic go to the University of Ulster. I think that the politicians, number one, need to start a discussion about people, particularly in this region, right, Niall and Pearce, that they go to the north. The nearest place for my son to go and do the degree that he wants to do, would be in Mayo, It would take 6 hours for him to go. So he goes to Coleraine, okay? All right? Now, the thing is, with the latest round of what's happening in the north and the University of Ulster, you've actually destroyed, right? The politicians in the north have destroyed Portrush and Coleraine. Those towns will be finished, right? Two towns that are from, let's just say, unionist backgrounds, right? By moving everything to McGee, that's going to cause a hell of a lot of problems in the north, and it's not been thought through. And what we want is unity with both of those communities. I can talk about both of those communities because I straddle them, actually, because I'm a British-born Protestant who lives with a Catholic family. I'm okay. They've not done anything to me. Do you know what I mean? I live with a Catholic family and I believe in a united Ireland and always have done. And do you know what? Go and talk to the man on the street in London. They have no idea why we're in Northern Ireland anyway. People do not understand. The only place that understands the North is Scotland. The rest of the country don't. Okay. Thank you and welcome to my TED Talk. Let's hope I'll get in again later on. But I'd like those questions answered about the university.
Yeah, of course. I don't know if either of our two other guests want to respond to that.
Yeah, well, I will.
Go on, Niall, you go first, please.
Yeah, I will, Greg. I too have a daughter at in Corian. So I don't think that servers in Corian are going to shut in favour of McGee, first of all. But there are 400 jobs being taken out across Ulster University, which is regretful. Moreover, you know, there's so much lifting you can do from the south. We put nearly 40 million into a medical school in Derry, and that's to help students along the border, particularly in Donegal. I think there needs to be a plan, and better planning by and I'm not, Pearce is not about Sinn Féin, by all parties in Northern Ireland, a greater plan about how the economy is managed, and rather than constantly finger pointing at what you haven't got, to plan better around what you do have. And you know, even over and above that, there are things that you could be helped planning for, and we'll get on to United Ireland stuff as well later.
Yeah, okay.
But the economy definitely could be handled a lot better. Though you can say one thing when you're in opposition, like. She mentioned carers there. She mentioned carers, like paid carers leave. You supported that when you're in opposition, and I mean you're the brief, and you don't. You know, you can't have it both ways.
Just to cover.
So can I ask a question there, Greg?
Yeah, go ahead. I was going to ask you a question.
That's fair. Let's have a real conversation about that there. So, I 100% agree with Niall. That the economy has to be managed better in terms of the North. And the Minister for the Economy is just Sinn Féin Minister. Let's be clear about this here. But just let's talk about the practical realities of that. What one practical or two or three does Niall have? Because he keeps on mentioning this here in terms of actually we do in terms of the economy. Because, like, so for example, paid carers leave. How do you fund that, Niall? It's like saying Donegal County Council would love to build that road or fix that pothole or to, you know, do the water system or the Gidore sewage scheme or whatever it is. See, unless they have funding, they can't do it.
For people who don't understand then, so, I mean, these are people that are elected and people went out of the way to vote for them and all that type of stuff. What does then the elected people in Northern Ireland collectively do to try and get better funding from Westminster, for an example? Are they going to meet with the new Andy Burnham there? He seems to want to decentralise things out of London, and he's talked of Belfast and Scotland. I mean, is a delegation going over? Is there a paper saying this is what we need to fulfil desire? So rather than saying it's all London's fault, happening politically to try and improve the situation then?
So all of those things are happening, right? And the Minister for the Economy and the Minister for Finance have been meeting with the Exchequer. The Minister for Finance leads those negotiations, leads with the Treasury in London regularly. There has been a case by all the political parties that the model of funding in the North is doesn't work. Basically, we are underfunded in the North significantly. And unless you have the funding, then you have to then make choices as to where the scant resources go. But everybody knows there's far more needed in terms of the North. We don't have, like, every year, Greg, I go through the finance bill. I've amended the finance bill. I've supported many parts of the finance bill. Our finance bills are hundreds of pages long. We bring forward proposals, like in last year's finance bill, for example, in relation to the regeneration of Letterkenny. Like, you know, it's that minor. But there is never a finance bill passed in the last 100 years that actually focuses on Derry, Belfast, Armagh, or anywhere else. And then there's other practical things. So just, you know, myself and my colleagues, Gary Doherty and others,
I don't want to get caught up in this. I just want to ask Niall one final question. Niall, I mean, you understand, don't you, the difference between a party, be it Sinn Féin or Fianna Fáil, whoever it might be. You understand the difference between, having a certain budget within Northern Ireland with which you have to sort of divvy out versus being in power in Dublin, whereby you've the power to, you know, raise more revenue, borrow on international markets, decide where monies go. You know, there's a big difference, is there not, in being in power from Dublin compared to what feels like effectively a small council in Northern Ireland. I mean, we all agreed that you can't necessarily test a party's ability to gather funds and spend in the north compared to the south.
Absolutely, there is no comparison.
Mm. But make the comparison all the time.
Yeah, but there is no comparison. But that said, let's go back to the point where Pierce said, yeah, there's a limited amount of choices to make. But government there can constantly ignore their ability to make any decisions. Okay. So water
that's
charges.
The point you're already
can I ask that question? Yeah. So let's take water charges. Pierce constantly talks about in the south, people that have the most should pay the most. That doesn't apply in the north. When it comes to water charges or rates,
water charges don't exist in the north. Niall, do you want water charges in the south? Because you're arguing a lot for it now.
Right.
At the minute. Just clarify.
Well, we're talking about the couple of things that you have, the couple of mechanisms you have to raise funds.
Right, we'll come.
The help people have needed in the north, okay. But you won't make the decisions.
Niall, you've made that.
We have made a decision very clear. We're not introducing water charges.
You want to help everything. You want to sit in your hands.
Maybe you should clarify whether you want water charges in the south as well. Let's try again.
Let's just be very clear. Would you welcome water charges in the south now?
We're prepared to take decisions when needed, Greg.
If it was required,
2008, 2011, we've done a lot of heavy lifting and really, really tough decisions on the Irish people.
Okay,
to bring our economy back.
And obviously,
can I ask a question of the two?
Yeah, well, can I take a break? Okay, can I take a break because I want to move on, and I'll come back to you, Katie, after these. Right, we've got all different jobs and all different responsibilities, but Katie, we are all equal, and that's why you were invited on to the panel. What did you want to say, sorry, before we move on to the next topic?
Okay, I'd just like to see if I could get a commitment from, I'm not asking for any promises, from Niall and from Pierce, right, is that it's you raise within your parties the possibility of anyone that attends a university that is based in the north, yeah, that they are subject to the same rules about fees as anyone that goes to university in the south.
Yeah, well, I did ask that question directly of the minister responsible at the time, and they says they were looking at it, but nothing since.
Yeah, it won't help me. I'm not doing it from a selfish point of view. It will help the future generations. It will also keep those universities in the north going, and particularly towns like Coleraine and Portrush and Port Stewart will be finished without that university there. And also, if I don't ask this, my son will actually kill me, that graduates from northern universities should get a vote in Senate elections. So there's the two points. I'm safe from a row with my son for not mentioning
it. Well, I'm
going
to row with him because I think everyone should have a vote in Senate elections the same way we do in the Dáil, personally.
Well, absolutely, Greg, but why are graduates from Northern universities at this stage left out? But I totally and 100% agree with you about that. Right?
Briefly, Niall, would you be supportive of, grants and facilitating people studying in the North equal to that, you know, whether they choose to go to Coleraine or Galway, and also Shannon voting, briefly, if you don't mind?
Yeah, so I'd be personally gunning for it, first and foremost, Greg. Mm-hmm. I'd be personally gunning for it.
Oh, yes, okay.
Promise.
I get you.
I've been pushing the minister and the Taoiseach numerous occasions in relation to this. And again, there's a lot of navel-gazing here, you'll say back to me. But it's someone that I expect to happen sooner rather than later.
What would the blocker? Is it a logistical situation, or someone just has to make the decision, or is it?
Well, I suppose it's negotiation with colleges, and it's lining maybe more than that, north and south. But I do feel the announcement will come, hopefully in the not too distant future.
I presume you'd welcome that too, Pierce.
Absolutely, Greg. We want to see, obviously, all the rules apply on the island of Ireland. And we've raised this issue in terms of university, those attending third level in the north, and the difficulties they have. And it's great that the stuff we have in terms of the tertiary university cluster here now in the northwest. Like one of the practical things, Greg, that I've been raising and trying to resolve with the government here in the south is like if your child goes to a university anywhere, on the island or on the south. They pay a 50% bus fare fee. If they go to the north, if they're going to Belfast, if they're going to Kilraen or Jordanstown, they only get the 50% as far as the border, and then the full whack has to be charged elsewhere. And this is things that can be resolved because if you get the free travel pass, it doesn't stop at the border. You can go, you can use the free travel right across the island of Ireland. We need to do the same thing for our students. And
Yeah,
if it's
that's very
vice
good.
versa, it's the same thing in terms of Derry to Letterkenny as well. So there are practical things that we can do. There are things that we need to work out. It's kind of one of the things that was the big topics of our meeting, myself and the First Minister and Pádraig McLaughlin meeting with business and education leaders in the council there earlier this week. And it was all the practical problems that exist as a result of the border and
I
how we
bet
can
you.
try and break them down.
Right,
Agree with
okay.
that, Greg, and can
Yep.
just say the relationship between us, the university, and the ATU is second to none. The
Okay.
cooperation there, where one can't facilitate a course, say a new company is coming into the region, and where one can't facilitate a course, the cooperation there to try and get the other
We've
facilitated
actually great
second to
integration.
none.
We've actually great integration on the ground if the government's actually would follow that, it would make an awful lot of sense because the models are there is how it all works. A lot of what we've talked about is the cost of living, be it in the north or wherever you might be. Now, we know the government now has delayed the restoration of fuel excise duty until September, this to avoid a sudden summer spike hike at the pumps. The haulage industry opposition argue this is just kicking the can down the road, warning that restoring these taxes will drive up the cost of living and transport, which of course it would. Katie, I'll come to you first. Do you believe the government should make these fuel tax cuts permanent to protect consumers and businesses? I think everyone would like that, but the reality is it fiscally irresponsible to permanently wipe hundreds of millions in excise revenue from the national budget? And I suppose create a situation where we're even more reliant on this money we shouldn't be reliant on, the corporation tax. What do you think?
Well, we've got to do it because people are on the breadline. I mean, I'm putting tenners in my car at the moment. To fill up the car fills me with dread. It's a big chunk out of your budget. Especially, I'm a carer. I'm very lucky in that my husband does work, so I'm not completely reliant upon carer's allowance, but it's a big chunk out of people. And the other thing is again, okay, in Letterkenny, I could probably use my car less. I'd love to have a proper transport scheme. People say to me after 27 years of being here, do you still miss London? And of course, aside from family, the one thing that I miss is transport. If I ever I go over to see my mum, I don't use a car. If I've drove over, it sits outside my mum's for 2 weeks. Do you know what I mean? Now, all right, we need a rail link. Another one, if I don't mention it, my son. We've become very reliant on the car here, and there's been no forward looking into transport links. So you need a car. I need a car to get about. And it's just it is a massive chunk out of people's money. And we need to look at other ways of raising that money. But then there's a lot of money wasted, as we know. There's a lot of waste in public jobs and stuff. And I say that as a former civil servant. Do you know what I mean? I see lots of waste. So we need to look at that. I mean, look, one of the things that was going to raise a ton of money for the government was the tax on vaping, right? Where's that money then?
Well, they're getting rid of disposable vapes anyway, so
No,
that's
but disposable ones, but the liquid ones, Greg, they went up tenfold.
You know what I mean? So good getting rid of disposable vapes, great, because they're filling up landfill. But the rechargeable ones, but where's all the money from this so-called scheme?
The vape juice increase. Okay, I get you. Pierce, your party's very clear. Would you, or is it very clear, would you be in favour, as the finance spokesperson, the fellow that drafts up the numbers, of keeping these deductions permanent?
Well, so, Greg, we're the only party that actually turned up for the debates the last two times that actually were opposed to this, and not only turned up but put down amendments making it very clear what we want to see and showing that there was an alternative. And we voted again on that amendment just this week. Unfortunately, the government have the numbers, and with the support of the Soc Dems and Labour, have voted that through. And it was, again, disappointing that INTU and Independent Ireland didn't even turn up for the debate in relation to that. But so let's be clear. You know, I said it to the ministers just 2 days ago when we were dealing with this debate, that we do not know what's going to happen in the Middle East, that the ceasefire was declared as over by Trump. And as a result of what we now know in the last 24 hours is that diesel is going up 10 cents at the weekend. Now, that can change. It's going up 10 cents, so it definitely is going up 10 cents, but it could also go down 10 cents the following day or the next week, depending on what's happening. But the idea that we were being asked to vote to increase the price of diesel by 34 cent between now and the 1st of December is something that I simply couldn't do. And as I said to
the minister...
But that's
to restore the price, though. It's not increasing as such. It's a restoration, is it not?
So it is to restore, but also increase, Greg. Actually, this is putting more money on it than was on it before, because they're also now putting up the carbon tax on petrol and diesel in October. So it is actually more than what was there. So what does that mean? It means that if prices remain the same as they are today, even before they go up 10 cents at the weekend, people will be charged over €2, well over €2 for a litre of diesel. And if they go up at the weekend and stay up, it could be 2.15. That is not acceptable. And there is no way, like at the end of the day, I am there to represent the people of Donegal. They have thankfully put their faith in me and my colleagues, you know, and the national elections.
But is this not just an easy one, though? I mean, at the end of the day, the reason me and Katie and others struggle at the pumps is because our electricity is the most expensive in Europe. The supermarkets continue to make billions off our backs.
100%. You're 100%
everywhere
right.
You look, we're being shafted. So is this not just a handy one for Sinn Féin to have a go at the government? The problem is it's cost of living right across the board.
100%. And that's why we've argued for a cost of living package. And come the autumn, I'm going to have to provide a costed alternative in showing how we can fund all of this, as I've done every single year as I've been a finance spokesperson, of how we can do this and how it can be funded and where the money comes from. And I will do that again, and we will continue to do that, because it doesn't need to be like this. The question here, Greg, is this year, step away even from the cost of living crisis. And Katie is so right in relation to Cathy is so right in relation to what is going on here and the pressure that people are under, and particularly carers and people who, you know, like who are really, really struggling with all the other things. Why is it that we tax petrol and diesel more in this country than any other country in Europe? And why is it that the government is asking us
we've got ambitious plans to reduce our emissions.
But see, so
how else do you do it?
But how else you do it? So making people pay more for diesel isn't reducing emissions. It's actually just collecting more taxes. As we can see from the figures, the government will take in more money in petrol and diesel now than ever before. And also what it's doing is it's making people in my community poorer. How you actually deal with reducing emissions is supporting families in relation to the transition that they have to do. But just penalising them because they have to go to work or, you know, go to that hospital appointment in Letterkenny or travel up the road is simply wrong.
Niall, let me go to Senator Niall Blaney now. Do you agree with the plans to restore and increase, because of the carbon tax, petrol and diesel? Would you agree with Pierce and Katie that this is a break that the families and the businesses, actually, in the farming community, that they need, and it should be retained? Because we have the financial capacity to retain it. We probably really do.
Well, I think it's important to take cognizance of why we're here. And the delicate situation in the Middle East, Greg, and the situation, as you know, is evolving. So government have said they've suspended decisions until September with a view to taking them in. But that said, we've also said that we're willing to respond when needed. So this is an evolving situation that we need to respond to. And if the situation that currently exists with the prices of fuel, etc., exists then, and there's going to be an onus on the government to continue to keep those.
So you're saying, do you think it's better that the government retains this flexibility because of the volatility of the situation, rather than, you know, you could have a situation, God forbid, where the 32 cent is retained, but the situation becomes so dire that the diesel is €2 with those reductions, and then what do you do?
Well, having this strategy long term is a non-runner, but the government need that flexibility to deal with the situation, probably maybe for another winter, and then see where things go. But we also need to make a decision at some stage, if it comes to it, can we do this in the longer term? But in the shorter term, the government are prepared to step up.
Okay.
Can I just say, just for information purposes, the problem here as well is the Dáil goes on holidays next week, and this law is passed, and the increase is going to happen when the Dáil is on holidays. So no matter what happens in the Middle East that we can control, and I agree with Niall in relation to this here, they have passed the law that this increase is happening, which I think is just stupid. It is reckless, and it doesn't take into account where people are going to be at this point in time. So if these prices go up at the weekend and you're charged, what, 186, 187 in terms of the pumps, then there's no way that you should be that the government should be putting up excise duty, because we don't need to at this point in time. We have billions of euro of surpluses. It is not necessary to fund education, health, or any other service. It is just doing it to, and will only put pressure on ordinary families. So the very least, they should have accepted our amendment, which was to make no decision on this issue in terms of increases until the budget, where it was reviewed at that time.
Right, back with
can
more.
Can I just say that?
Yes, of course you
right,
can. Yep.
On this one, Piers is absolutely right, because it's an evolving situation, right? We still don't know what's happening. Trump's been busy, you know, talking to FIFA rather than trying to get peace, as he said he would. But anyway, this is a really expensive time of year for ordinary families, right? And I'm not telling the two politicians, how to suck eggs here, but because they both got kids, right? You're looking at back-to-school costs, right? You've got the whole summer to try and keep them entertained and go to camps and stuff like that. And then we move into the winter period where the temperature's going to drop and bang, you're on Christmas. There's no reason why this could not have been delayed until at least March.
Mm. But would you like to see it more...
Over this,
like, not everyone drives. Not everyone drives. Would it not be better to sort of come up with a scheme that's sort of beneficial and addresses, you know, those everyday costs that you talk of, rather than, you know, just those that are driving, for an example?
Yes, but fuel hikes affect everybody, right? It's not just about driving.
Yeah.
It's about
getting
the transport
stuff.
Of I goods, right? And those price increases go on that. So I think the most expensive period in living, yeah, is between the months of September and March, because you have all of those costs come up every year.
Uh-huh.
And if you'd have even delayed it until March and then looked at it after then, you know, just to get us over this bloody winter, because we are looking at extremes in temperatures at the moment. I mean, you know, we've avoided, unfortunately, the extreme heat here. We've had summers happened already last Tuesday. But, you know, we need to look at those. This is the most expensive period coming up,
I think okay, listen, just because of a backup, we are going to have to leave it there. Katie, thank you so much as always for joining us. The hour certainly flies. Have a
thank
good
you.
One
I couldn't believe the big hitters that were on the panel today, and you had little old me there, you know
yeah.
what I mean
okay yeah well listen me Pearson Niall, we're not that big hit. Oh, you're not on about me, are you? All right, then. See you.
Oh, my God. Bye-bye.
Niall, thanks very much indeed.
Thanks very much, Greg.
I really appreciate your time. That's Senator Niall Blaney and Deputy Piers Doherty. Good luck to you. Have a great weekend, all 3 years.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Greg.
How are you all keeping? I hope you're very well indeed, and I hope the weather's nice wherever you are. Or it's how you want it to be. We're all different, aren't we? Some people dread the slightly warmer weather, but you keep hearing about all of these weather warnings and what have you, and here we are. It's just a nice, almost spring day rather than summer day. Just to let you know, by the way, we're going to be playing... I'll come back to that, actually, because there's a more timely time for me to mention that for you. Congratulations and best wishes to our nephew, Brian Joseph O'Donnell and Danielle Gallagher, getting married today in Burton Port. Hope you both have a wonderful day from your godparents, Phil McKevy and Anne Power. Thank you. Have a great day. It's a lovely day to get married, I think. Best wishes again to our nephew, Brian Joseph O'Donnell and Danielle Gallagher, getting married, as I mentioned, in Burton Port. Lots of love this time from Auntie Mary and Uncle Paddy McKelvey in Fintown. Thank you. Please play something. It's going to be the request on this show for John and Anne Porter in Buncrana. 55 years married today. What a wonderful milestone for you are. For you all. Hello, I was wondering if you could help us out. Our SVP volunteers from Letterkenny and Dunfanaghy are holding a community pop-up show. It's tomorrow from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. It's in the Ozanam Centre in Dunfanaghy. We're obviously trying to raise much needed funds at this very challenging time for many. Could you please help us by adding this to your community notices? Well, there you are. So if you want to help SVP in the fantastic work that they do, get along to the pop-up shop tomorrow between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. at the Ozanam Centre in Dunfanaghy. We're going to take a look now at this week's Greg Hughes podcast. It's the sister podcast of this station. Obviously, it allows us an opportunity to have more in-depth talks with some amazing people, because the show necessarily doesn't allow that, and some stories just need that extra space. I think we're up to episode 30 now, between bonus episodes and scheduled episodes, and it's proved incredibly popular. And just on behalf of myself and Caroline Orr, who researched and produced the podcast, we just want to thank you, by the way, for the loyal listeners. The way podcasts work now, you get stats, and week after week the podcast is growing, and you see you don't see who's returning, but you think, right, obviously people are liking it and they're tuning in. So what is a podcast, if you don't know, by the way? It's just a different way to listen to audio, and we stream it on our website, highlandradio.com, so you can listen to it every Friday morning from 11 and then throughout the course of the week. And also you can download it to listen to it when you're out walking or whatever, but also you can search the Greg Hughes podcast on any podcast platform at all: YouTube, Spotify, if you've got an Apple device, on Podbeam. It's across them all, okay? So wherever you get your podcasts, it should be there for you. And we've got two very special guests this week, and all our guests are fantastic, right? But I don't know, there was just a particular... I just enjoy being in these people's company. They are Colin and Ethna Bell. Now, back in June of 2013, their world was turned upside down when their 26-year-old son, Kevin, was tragically killed in a hit-and-run in New York. Now, out of that immense grief, the Bells founded the Kevin Bell Repatriation Trust. It's a 32-county charity which has since brought home over... Wait for this. Firstly, it's unbelievable the amount of people that pass away abroad, but also how many the Kevin Bell Repatriation Trust has helped. 2,500 Irish citizens who died suddenly abroad. They have an international network of people that they can deal with, and just like that there, they are able to repatriate people home. And an interesting part in this podcast, which you won't hear all of it because I can only play a clip, is the fact that they believe, and I mentioned this before, 10, that they had to lose Kevin for this to happen, but that Kevin guides them. They won the lotto. Kevin guided them there. But they've also got a wonderful large family of two sets of twins and other siblings as well. I could go on and on and on, but then what's the point in having the podcast? I just found them so astonishing. Well, in this clip, and it's a powerful clip, Ethna and Colin recount the exact moment they received that devastating news of the loss of Kevin and how the trust began to begin to take shape shortly after. You know, take a listen.
Ah, well, we were so lucky. I mean, we didn't get a cold call. Kevin had gone out to a friend of his, Seamus Toner, who was living in New York, and Kevin had gone out to stay with him and loved New York and stayed on. And on that morning, it was 13 years ago, it was the 16th of June. I was actually 60 on the 15th of June, and myself and two of our sons were out the back putting up a gazebo because people were coming up to celebrate, you know, family were coming to celebrate my 60th birthday. And I got called into the house, and Seamus Toner's parents, Caroline and Vinny, were there. And what had happened was that Seamus had heard about it, and he had phoned his parents immediately and said to get up to the Bells and give them the news before they get a cold call from the police or whatever in New York. So we were so, so lucky and we're so grateful to Caroline and Vinny for doing that, because, as I say, I don't imagine how we would have reacted or what we would have done, you know, to get a cold call, you know.
And what happened to Kevin Athna?
One night in the evening, and he'd actually rung the night before to wish Colin a happy birthday. So I was on the phone to him for about half an hour, and he was saying, I'm the Snapchat king, with the different things that he would do. And he'd got taxi back to his apartment, and whenever he got out the taxi, a white van came.
Do you want to take over? Yeah. He got out of his taxi and was on the pavement, and a white van out of control mounted the pavement and hit him, put him onto the road where another vehicle hit him.
Just and senseless. The no rhyme or reason to it.
But both vehicles drove off. Yeah. I suppose mercifully now Kevin was killed instantly. I mean, he wouldn't have known an awful lot about it.
The Snapchat king. So he was mad on the social. He'd have loved it now then with TikTok and everything else that's going.
Absolutely. He would have gone back to the apartment and said to his mate, okay, I've got a great idea. Now, and he would have stood as though he was surfing. And yes. He would have had on a pair of shorts, and then he would have drawn waves and surfing USA. Or else he would have been like this and singing Postman Pat, and he didn't have a note in his head, and driven away. Drawn a wee red van, Postman Pat. And then, what was the other one? Another one, Superman. I believe I can fly. I was just actually looking them up on the computer. That was the time you had the screen in front of you.
Yeah.
I was looking up his Snapchats whenever Caroline and Vinny came to the door.
It's so tough, and I'm so sorry, Ethna, for everything that you've gone through. And you, of course, Colin.
It happens all the time with me. Yeah.
But it's from a place of love and the happy memories too, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. You always smile when you're thinking about them.
Yeah. So when the next two families after that you were able to help, like, what is the balance between sort of the financial implications of it and the logistics of it? Because I would imagine, you know, before the repatriation trust was there, where do you even go? All you hear is, you know, the embassy's liaising or something like that there. But what happens now? Was it, which is the biggest strain on a family? Is it the cost or the logistics of even knowing where you might begin?
Well, I mean, you get news like that, you know, you might get a cold call and say, like, well, what do we do now? Or who do we contact? Or where do we go? And that's the, I suppose that, I mean, when it happened to us, we were so, so lucky. Now, we have taken over 2,500 people home to Ireland. And in the 13 years, there was never a repatriation as quick as our Kevin's. It was unbelievable. Kevin was killed, as I say, 2:45 on Sunday morning. His post-mortem took place on Sunday afternoon. Ethna's cousin, Nasa Negonal, she lived in New York, and she knew a lot of people in New York. Kevin had been with the Armagh Gaelic team in New York, and the boys from the Gaelic team picked Nasa up, and she would tell them, right, we have to go here. And they would go, and she would get whatever paperwork signed that was needed, or if she was told to come back, she said, no, I have a family at home, I need to get this signed now, with the result that all Kevin's paperwork was done on the Monday. His body was released to the undertaker on Monday evening. He was on the plane home on Tuesday evening, and he was in our house on Wednesday at lunchtime. I mean, there has to be a reason for that, you know. I mean, it was just incredible. So,
and would you? Everyone thinks different, and often we think couples, and they must have this blanket opinion. But like, do both of you share a sense that, you know, sometimes things are just meant to happen not for a reason as such, but there's too much going on for it just to be happen chance.
Yes, yeah. Well, like, in all honesty, I mean, we believe, rightly or wrongly, you know, but it gives us comfort anyway that Kevin was sent to be the character he was, and to die early, and to be the catalyst for the setting up of this trust.
I defy anyone to contradict you because the evidence is there. 2,500 people. Mm-hmm. That's mums and dads, granny and granddad, sisters and brothers. The amount of lives his sacrifices touched is just remarkable. And it all began with one of the simplest repatriations compared to the cases that you've dealt with. At what point, after, you know, you were able to offer the financial system assistance to the families of the deceased that died after Kevin, did it become clear there was something here that you could establish, Ethna?
Well, it was just, as I say, whenever it became known to us, and every death that we saw, and we were approaching the people, and then it got to the stage that we thought, right, we possibly can do something more than this, because actually 8 months after Kevin was killed, my sister's son Paul was killed in San Francisco under the same circumstances.
Not
hit and run. Yeah.
My word.
So Paul was number 13, and that was in February. And whenever you think that Kevin had been killed in the June, so during those few months, we were just looking out, and it was very few, really, whenever you think of the numbers that are there at the moment.
But still 13 in that period of time
from
is
June
a lot
to February.
Then.
Yeah.
But obviously compared to mm-hmm. the amount of people you've helped since, that's unbelievable.
But
I wasn't aware of that.
It was just a matter of Colin getting into the logistics and who to contact. And so all the people have to do now is contact KBRT and give the name of the deceased, whatever details they can give, where they are at the moment and who they're coming home to.
But I presume that means that over the years, other organisations, be it the consulate or whatever, has had to change for you guys to plug into, if you know what I mean. So what is the process now, once you might get notified of the name of a deceased? Or maybe there's not a one-size-fits-all, but what is the process that happens next?
Well, immediately we go off the phone and the information of where the deceased is and where he's coming home to, and the undertaker at home and the main point of contact. And then we go straight into, we've so much experience with dealing with undertakers in certain places like Sydney. We would have our preferred undertaker, or New York, we would have 3 or 4 different undertakers we use for different areas, for Thailand or for Spain or whatever. We know who to contact.
Wow, okay.
So, I mean, it's then, and as I say, like for a long time, I mean, we used to have to put the money up front, but now we don't.
Yeah, indeed. And they're so grateful, aren't they? It's astonishing. And I could have sat and listened to the rest of that podcast. The full podcast available for you from 11 a.m. on our website or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, let's say good morning now to our good friend Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn and Company. Hi, Seamus.
Morning, Greg. How are we?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good, good to be here. Yeah. It's livening up. It's livening up on the banks of the Lennon.
I was going to say to you, which office are you in? A good buzz around the place.
There's only one office to be in. There's only one office to be in at the moment.
Well, you know, you can say that. All right. Come here. Just an interesting take on this, because I know you have an interest in it. And for some reason, Donald Trump, he wants to put his face on passports. He wants to put his name on dollar bills or $200 bills or whatever it might be. He wants to rename airports and all manner of things. So he announced, that Palm Beach Airport in Florida would be renamed to honor US President Donald J. Trump. So from now on, its new call sign is DJT. It has happened. What do you think about this?
It has happened, yes, Greg, yeah. Earlier in the, just a couple of few days back, there was this announcement come in from last week. Yeah, that the DJT International replaces the PBI International Airport. And what does it all mean? Does it really mean anything to the larger public? As far as cost goes, probably not. But there's this underlying, I think you've just touched on it yourself. Like, I think he has a commemorative coin, a 24 carat. He's renaming buildings, yes, and renaming airports. Now, that's in its own way is not unusual. That has happened in many, many cases and many instances. But the honoree, as it were, it is just a part of the honor of being named and associated with a building. And there's not supposed to be any commercial opportunity for any gain for the honoree. So in this particular instance, what's peculiar about it is in advance of the renaming, the Trump organization, the commercial organization, registered the trademarks to protect the trade name of DTI, International Airport, so that can be used even in other airports. So this might be the first of more to follow. You wouldn't know, but they can control who is the vendors there. They can oversee the accounts. So it's maybe a little bit more than a name, although that's on the face of it. But it's just this insidious use of public spaces and the move to this branding to create what I think is this personal legacy, which it goes a bit further than just a name. And I think he has this idea to perpetuate the Trump name going forward and to influence people in his way of thinking and that type of, well, I suppose the attitude that he has adopted to politics, which goes against the grain with an awful lot of others.
So why would Palm Beach International Airport get involved in this, especially considering, you know, how the name was pre-registered, etc.? I'm not sure. I haven't sampled the water there yet. Do they see this as an honour? I mean, the Palm Beach International Airport's a fine name in and of itself. It's quite descriptive, right? So do we know, yes, were their arms twisted in relation to this? Does it just take a favourable governor? I don't know.
Well, maybe what you hit or just referenced there when you mentioned a favourable governor. The governor, as you know, is Ron DeSantis, and he's a Republican. And actually, I believe I'm subject to correction, but Donald Trump Boulevard going to Mar-a-Lago from the airport, which has been renamed. And I think there's a 200K stretch of motorway now being named in South Florida after him as well. So this is more of the same, but it's where they overlap and where you're trying to maybe use this the Trump name and the Trump logo to create what may be more like a commemoration using the branding for a legacy.
But some of this has already been undone, Seamus.
I think that that's more subtle.
Yeah.
But I think that that's where it's going.
But look, some of this has already been undone. But is the reality not this? And there are Trump supporters out there and there are those that aren't. But when he goes from office and the media then is not really afraid to talk about some of the stuff that he's been up to, you know, this is going to be like pulling pulling statues down in Texas, though, isn't it? I mean, it's not a forever legacy. It's here and now. But I would say it's inevitable that this will be undone down the line, because I imagine when he's not there able to control really what is said, it might become a bit of a toxic brand.
If your forecast is correct, when you say when he's gone, which is presumptuous, maybe slightly. If he's considering his legacy and if he's considering another generation of Trump coming onto the ticket maybe later, that mightn't have been mooted yet, but that's I wouldn't entirely rule it out, that he's thinking on a much bigger screen as far as perpetuating his name going forward. Now, but dealing with your point, which is actually interesting, because it has already been approached during his sitting term. It mightn't fly at all, but the guy who was wouldn't be one of his supporters, Bernie Sanders, he has already introduced a bill or an act to bring into Congress, which is to stop executive renaming for vanity and ego act. And if that went through, and that is a mouthful in itself, but if that went through, ironically, Donald J.T. Trump would have to actually sign it into law himself. And what's the chances of that happening? But that is something that he is trying to enact now and to retrospectively remove these names. So, yes, you could be absolutely correct later on. But I think that his psychic is such that he believes in perpetuating his legacy, his name, and the use of that going forward on highways and airports. He believes that can keep that Trump ethos out there, and also what he stands for, and as it were, make people take note and maybe believe in this type of politics that he has introduced, which is, I think, scary to us all.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether it can outlast him, but anyway, what are the chances of Donegal International Airport becoming the Greg Hughes International?
I have no issue with that at all, okay. Because it'll be an honour for you to be so named. But you won't be controlling who's trading out of it, I'm sure.
No, I certainly won't. Right, now we're in the company of Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin Gunn Solicitors, Letterkenny and Remelton. And we've got some questions, as you can imagine. Could you ask Seamus what are my rights when I got bad diesel from a garage? I've been using it since it opened a few years ago. I put €60 in it every week and a half. Suddenly, I might be going to work and the car stops. Turned out bad diesel caused. It's now in the garage getting the fuel pump and tank taken out, cleaned and lines cleaned. Cost will be at least €600. I've contacted the company and told them they know, but they haven't replied yet. What's the situation here? This comes in quite a bit, actually, Seamus.
Yeah, we've addressing it. We have seen it in different guises before, Greg, and but it is very difficult. It seems that the caller has been using the same supplier from the way they phrased the question for some time. And now they have this issue. Obviously, it's going to have to be addressed. But it'll come down to proof and to get it a little, to bring it into sort of the litigious sphere and to consider maybe mounting some type of a legal action. You're going to have to prove that the diesel was substandard and that it did cause the fault. So to do that, I would say you're going to have, would likely have to get some type of laboratory testing done and get an analysis done in the first instance. So that's maybe your first port of call. And what's that going to cost you? You know, so you have to bear that in mind. But I think that if you're going to take it on, you better be properly armed, and you're going to need at least that. And then you're probably going to need some type of engineer a mechanical type engineer to be able to associate that, to link that to the diesel, to the damage that's done to the car. And with those type of reports, you could certainly look to mounting an action, get onto your legal people about it, and go from there if the supplier does not deal with it. But the supplier could very correctly say, well, look, no, it's not us. And you have to prove your case. It's a civil action on the balance of probability. So to do that, you're going to have to do some further investigation, technical investigation, which unfortunately will be expensive. Now, if you win your case, you're entitled to get those costs back and to get all the costs of the experts' reports back as part of your claim. And that's unfortunately, initially, would probably have to be fronted by yourself. So in retailing, they probably have insurance for this type of issue and would be passed on to their insurance company. And then it would depend on what type of attitude they want to take to it, whether they want to invest thousands in trying to defend it or to deal with it. But I mean, that if you're going to go down that route, you best start looking about getting some form of technical analysis done to prove the actual complaint, rather than just saying, oh, it's faulty diesel. I mean, there could be many issues that arise.
Yeah, and it's not your fault, but even as you describe it, it's difficult. And I'm just wondering, that diesel's probably already down a drain somewhere, disposed of correctly by the garage, don't get me wrong, but then you'd have to, they could challenge what was already present in the tank. And it sounds like it would be a difficult one to prove. You would just maybe...
And they could say, well, look at you're on the road. You could have got it anywhere else too. You know, it could have been a mix. Could have got some in one station. Could have got some in Dublin. Could have got some in Donegal. You know, there's angles there that are going
to
be...
Was your tank empty when you put our diesel in?
Type of thing, yeah. It's going to be very difficult, you know. Yeah. Yes, and if the evidence is gone, it doesn't help any. It doesn't help any. But then I think you'd have to try to deal with that and say, well, okay, let's move to the engineer and say, well, would faulty diesel have that impact on the car and the engine or the mechanical parts that the complaint arises? Is it consistent with that? And that would be some help, I think, moving forward with it. But again, that's not going to come cheap. You're going to have to invest in that. You're going to have to get an expert in the field, like a mechanical engineer, earring expert, not just with all due respect, some guy that's working in a garage that knows cars very well. You know, if you're going to go down the road with this, you're going to end up probably having to go to court, and you're going to have to bring on some expert advice, and that's an expert report, and that is certainly going to be a commitment, a financial commitment by the caller.
My aunt died at the end of last year, and her house has appeared on propertyregister.ie as being sold in December, even though it hasn't gone through probate. Where are they getting this info, and can something be done about such misinformation as they describe it?
Yeah, it's a very peculiar question. There's a kind of a presumption in it that that the individual, when she passed away, has bequeathed this property to someone. Because if that's not the case, and let's just tease this out, if that's not the case, there's nothing to have stopped that individual selling that during the lifetime, and that now it appears as a property that has been sold. And the caller wouldn't be privy to that information. The caller references misinformation. I mean, if the way to check it out is, I think, as follows. You can get on to Land Direct and you can do a search. And that's the portal for doing searches against titles that are registered with the PRA. And then you will see who is the current registered owner. And at that point then, you'll see probably what date they became the current registered owner, if it has changed. And then you could do some further digging with regard to how that was done and what instrument was used to do that. And if that was done during the person's lifetime, the person may very well have sold it during their lifetime. So the misinformation, I'm not sure what register they're referring to, but I think Land Direct and start there and then put the pieces together logically rather than maybe jumping to conclusions.
Is it legal to have or illegal to have two car insurance policies in the same car? My son's working abroad for a while, has a car here insured. My daughter's car is broken down and then transferred her insurance onto the son's car, which obviously isn't being used. But they've been told that this is illegal. Now, her own insurance may well cover her to drive her brother's car, dependent on her age and stuff. But anyway, I'll just go with the information that we have, yeah, Seamus.
Yeah, no, that's you're actually right. If you, I think, is it over 25? I think is the age, and if you have a holder of a full license, a lot of policies. If you have a policy,
you have
in
to
your
be 25
name,
or something, though.
Yeah, I think it's 25. Yeah, that it allows you to drive any vehicle that's not yours. So there wouldn't even in that situation be the necessity maybe of a change of cover of a change of policy. What's interesting is when they say that it's illegal. Well, I mean, if you're not insured, it's certainly illegal to have two policies of insurance in a car. Is that illegal? Well, that doesn't strike me as that. That strikes me as being an insurance company's policy. Maybe they're underwriters, whereby they're not happy that that party who would be the insured, i.e. their client, does not have an insurable interest in the car because they're not the owner of the car.
Yeah, that's it.
And I think that that's probably where the insurer is coming from, and that is more than likely a policy within that insurance company. So they could certainly shop around and see does that apply elsewhere. To say that it's illegal, I don't grab that, and I would have some misgivings about that. But I think a simple solution, maybe even this, if it mightn't cost an awful lot, it'd be worth checking. The individual could, I believe, become a named driver on that policy. If that's the brother, she's a sibling, say. I think that's what she says, the brother.
Yep.
And the brother's abroad, and the brother's the owner of the car, the brother's the owner of the policy. So why not add the caller's name as a named driver on the policy?
But you're paying double then, because you have to pay.
Just as a named driver. There would be something, but it'd be a tariff, but it wouldn't be exorbitant.
I think I hope there's not a brother in New York somewhere completely oblivious to the fact that his sister's driving around in his car. I'm sure that's not the case, but
once he has his consent,
of course, I know.
There shouldn't be any issue. But yeah, the two policies. The other thing about it is this, though. Again, coming down to cost. It seems a bit ludicrous to be paying two premiums on the one motor vehicle, but there is some point about the insurable interest on the owner, yeah, and insurance companies want the owner to have the insurable interest.
It's
and to
so
be
difficult,
the policyholder.
Yeah, but he's retaining that policy, I'm sure, because he knows that if it discontinues and he's away for a while and then comes back, he's going to get absolutely hammered.
Absolutely,
because of the
yeah, and that has happened. That has happened in the past. So it'd be very interesting to get the take of some of the big, the big insurance companies on that as to what their view is. But I think that it rather than being illegal, I think it could be a company policy.
Thank you so much. Have a lovely weekend. Enjoy the festival.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Look after yourself.
Wish everyone the very best with it. Yeah, it's the place to be.
And if people want to check you out online, I've checked. You are there, so you don't need the caveats. Where is it?
Good. Well, if you're not at the festival, you're sure you can check us out at gun.ie. Keep it simple, Greg.
All right, Slán, thank you. Brendan Devaney, our GEA friend, joins us now. We're going to look forward to the two semi-finals. We'll start tomorrow. Now then to the match standing, just one game away from their first All-Ireland final appearance in generations, continuing a historic run. They face a battle-hardened Mayo side, though, of course, under heavy pressure, to finally capture the Sam Maguire. Mayo look to use their extensive Croke Park experience to control their pace against a dangerous, high-momentum Louth outfit. How's it going to go?
Yeah, that's a hook. Listen, great intro there, Craig. Maybe we could do something together down covering the games at Saturday.
Taking the Queen's dollar.
Yeah. We could do an intro like yourself there. I'll get you a wee job on the sideline.
Yeah, so, I mean, when we've seen how Louth have performed, we talked about resilience in the Donegal team, and I think we've talked about it before in the past. Are they to be beaten? Well, maybe they will eventually, but are Mayo the team to beat them?
You know, Greg, just, I suppose it's been a strange season in some ways. I mean, the Dublin performance when they got hammered in Leinster and they played a bit of a kind of zonal dropping off Dublin ripped them apart. And you were wondering, maybe this isn't going to be a good season. So Louth completely changed their tactics after that went out, after people pushed up the pitch and were more aggressive, and it suited them so much better. I just think that's particularly maybe a bit lucky to beat Armagh in the manner that they did, but they certainly have moved on a lot. Now, that Armagh victory obviously gave them straight into the All-Ireland quarters, and then the performance down to 14 men must give them such courage. Greg, listen, you mentioned Mayo, 75 years within All-Ireland. It's actually less for Louth. Louth won it in 69. Famous story of the captain. He was a show band singer. He landed in when the team was going around in the pre-match walk. He only landed at the game, probably smoking a cig back in the day, you know. But things have changed so much here. But Mayo, of course, the pressure of finals isn't here for them. This is a semi-final, and normally they equip themselves very well in that. The three inside have been unbelievable. You know, obviously Kobe McDonald has lit it up this year, but young Burnham beside him, along with Ryan O'Donoghue, I mean, they accounted for 19 of their 23 points last day out. So they have a serious forward line. So, listen, Louth, their height and midfield, I think, is where they'll look to do it. I mean, Darragh McDonald, the last day, just had an unbelievable game for them. You know, their subs as well coming on. Byrne, McDonald, and these fellas, like Sam Mulroy, is one of the best captains, one of the best players in the country. So, set up for an absolute cracker.
Who's going to get it? And, I mean, you know, you're going to be there. The weather's beautiful. The pitch is beautiful. It's a sellout. You can actually enjoy it because you're not up to high dough. Who's gonna come out on top?
Yeah, do you know what, Greg? It's a very different experience. Obviously, with Donegal not there, because that type of emotion where you're following the game, you're obviously so invested, so want the team to win. There is a wee bit more of a relaxed case and not the same traffic as well at times. But listen, Greg, this game's impossible to call. You know, both teams are there on merit. Both teams probably didn't maybe expect them. This is year one for Andy Mourne. They definitely are evolving. We've seen bits and pieces of good Mayo play, but they're very dependent on those three inside. Now, Tommy Conroy will give him a lift coming off the bench. I just think coming down the stretch with Louth, just the courage in the game that they had last day out there, and with their own bench as well, contributing so much to their play, right. I think Louth might sneak this.
Right, okay, arguably the ultimate rivalry in this game. For the 34th time in championship history, it's Dublin versus Kerry. Defending champions, of course, aiming to reach their second consecutive final. Dublin look to return to the decider for the first time since their 23 triumph over the same team. So we're going to expect, aren't we, a high-quality tactical battle between the two heavyweight squads. And we've got David Clifford, we've got Conor O'Callaghan, to name just two. If it was tight to call the first game, is it going to be as tough to call this one, or is the momentum with Kerry, or are Dublin do what Dublin do and they're just getting good at the right time?
Yeah, this would be an amazing season. The more than now, Dublin had that bad game. Well, I don't want to take anything away from Mark McHugh's Westmeath, but after getting relegated in that performance where they were beat in the Leinster final, a lot of people were questioning where they're going. Even the Cavan game before they played us, Craig, they were so in the match. So we just, if they've really in the last couple of games found some serious form. And if this was a few games back, I'd expect an easy one for Kerry. Now, I don't think so, Greg. If you look through the 11, 13, 15, 16, 19 championships, Dublin won them all. Now, Kerry won in 22, but then Dublin came back and beat them in 23. So Dublin have this thing over Kerry. And I know teams have changed in that, but certainly the pressure's on them. You look at how tired Kerry looked, particularly at the end of the Tyrone game. You know, you've players come back from injury and that, I wonder just if some of them, have they got the same kind of level of fitness? It's hard to get that block of training and build yourself on the championship.
In 10 seconds, who's going to win it?
I'm going to go for Dublin after extra time.
Surprise. Wowzers, nice one. Brendan, listen, enjoy the weekend. Work's not bad sometimes, is it, down there for two cracking matches?
It should be a bit of fun on Saturday night as well.
Yeah, typical of you. Go on. Good luck. Look after yourself, Brendan Devaney there. Best of luck, too, to the Donegal Masters. They're just a game away from an All-Ireland final themselves, so we wish them all the best. We're back with you Monday morning at 9 o'clock. Have a fantastic weekend, everybody.